wise you put on the company's record were going to help George succeed? Like I said, not at the time, not last summer. Mason rubbed his palms up and down his thighs. They were now moving towards something that was uncomfortable for him.
So at some point you did come to know this?
He nodded but didn't speak.
When? Bosch prompted.
That would have been about 6 weeks ago.
Tell me.
One night, I pulled over a taxi, saw the guy roll a stop sign and pulled him over. It was a black and white, and right away the guy starts giving me the shit about collusion and all this. And I'm thinking, yeah. Just touch your nose with your forefinger, asshole. But then he says, you and Irving Jr. are doing this to us. And I'm like, what the hell? So I get in his face, and I tell him to tell me exactly what he means by that. And that's when I found out my friend Georgie was repping another cab company, putting the move on black and white. Bosch leaned forward, closer to Mason, and put his elbows on his knees. They were getting to the center of it now.
What did you do?
I confronted him. I went to George and gave him every way out, but at the end of the day, there was no way out. I felt he and his father had used me, and I told him that. I told him we weren't friends anymore, and that was the last time I saw him.
Bosch nodded. And this is why you think he killed himself?
Mason scoffed. No, man. If he used me like that, then I wasn't really that important in his life. I think he killed himself for other reasons. I think Chad leaving was a big thing. Maybe there were other things. The family had secrets. You know what I mean? Mason didn't know about McQuillan or the marks on George Irving's back. Bosch decided that this wasn't the time for him to find out.
Okay, Mason. You have anything else for me?
Mason shook his head. You didn't confront the councilman about all of this, did you?
Not yet.
Bosch thought about that.
You going to the funeral tomorrow?
I hadn't decided yet. Tomorrow morning, right?
Yeah.
I guess I'll decide then. We were friends a long time. Things just sort of went wrong at the end.
Well, maybe I'll see you there. You can go now.
I appreciate you telling the story.
Yeah.
Mason stood up and headed toward the back hallway, his head down. Bosch watched him go and wondered about the vagaries of relationships and investigations. He had come to the division expecting to confront a cop who was bent, who had crossed the line. Instead, he now viewed Mason as another victim of Irvin Irving. And on the top of the list of Irving's victims was his own son. Mason might not have to worry about confronting the councilman. Bosch might get there first.
Chapter 25. George Irving's Thursday morning funeral was crowded, but it was hard for Bosch to tell if all the people were there to mourn the loss of George Irving or to buttress their ties to his father, the city councilman. Many of the city's political elite were there along with command staff of the police department. Even Councilman Irving's opponent in the upcoming election, the guy who didn't have a chance, was present. It was as if a truce in politics had been called so respect could be shown for the dead. Bosch stood on the periphery of the graveside gathering and watched the parade of who's who make their way to Irvin Irving and the rest of the dead man's family to offer condolences. It was Bosch's first look at Chad Irving, the third generation of the family. He clearly favored his mother in his looks. He stood next to her with his head down, barely looking up whenever someone offered a hand or a grip of the upper arm. He seemed bereft, whereas his mother was tearless and stoic, possibly operating behind a pharmaceutical haze. Bosch was so intent on studying the family and political permutations of the scene that he didn't notice Kiz Ryder slip away from the police chief's side. She came up on Harry's left, as silent as an assassin.
Harry?
Bosch turned.
Lieutenant Ryder, I'm surprised to see you here.
I came with the chief.
Yeah, I saw that. Big mistake.
Why's that?
I wouldn't be showing support for Irvin Irving right about now. That's all.
Have things advanced since our discussion yesterday?
Yeah, you could say that.
Bosch summarized his interview of Robert Mason and the clear implication that the councilman was complicit in the effort to move the Hollywood taxi franchise from B&W to Regent. He said that effort likely triggered the events that led to George Irving's death.
Will Mason testify?
Bosch shrugged.
I never asked him, but he knows the score. He's a cop, and he likes his job. Enough to end his friendship with George Irving when he realized he was being used. He knows if he's called to testify and he refuses, then his career is over.
I think he'll testify. I'm surprised he's not here today. I thought maybe there might be some fireworks.
Ryder scanned the crowd. The service was over and people were starting to drift off amidst the tombstones, heading to their cars.
We don't want fireworks here, Harry. If you see him, you head him off.
It's over. He didn't come.
So what's your next move?
Today's the big day. I'm going to bring McQuillan in for a conversation.
You don't have enough to charge him.
Probably not.
I've got a forensic team at the hotel right now with my partner. They're taking a second run at it. If we can put McQuillan in that suite or on the fire escape, it's over.
A big if.
There's also his watch and the possibility of matching it to the wounds on the back.
Ryder nodded.
That might work, but as you mentioned before, it won't be conclusive. We'll have our experts say it's a match. He'll have his experts say it's not.
Yeah. Listen, Lieutenant, I think I'm about to have some company. You might want to move out of the way.
She scanned the remaining crowd.
Who?
Irving's been watching me without really watching me. I think he's going to come over. He's waiting for you to leave, I think.
All right, then I'll leave you to it. Good luck, Harry.
If that's what it takes.
See you, kids.
Stay in contact.
Roger that.
She walked off and headed toward a clot of people surrounding the chief of police. Almost immediately, Irvin Irving took advantage of seeing Bosch alone and headed toward him. Before Bosch could address him, Irving said what was on his mind.
It's a devastating thing to put your son in the ground and not even know why he was taken.
Bosch had to hold himself back. He had decided that now was not the time to confront Irving. There was still work to be done. McQuillan first, then Irving.
I understand, he said. I hope to have something for you soon, the next day or two.
That's not good enough, Detective. I've not heard from you, and what I hear about you is not comforting. Are you working another case besides the investigation of my son's death?
Sir, I have a lot of open cases, and things don't come to a standstill because a politician pulled strings and put me on a new one. All you need to know is that I am working the case, and we'll have an update for you before the week is out.
I want more than an update, Bosch. I want to know what happened, and who did this to my son. Are we clear?
Sure, we're clear.
And what I would like now is to speak to your grandson for a few minutes.
Could you...
It's not a good time.
It's never going to be a good time, Councilman. But if you're going to demand results, then you can't stop me from throwing the net. I need to talk to the victim's son.
He's looking at us right now. Would you please wave him over?
Irving looked back at the gravesite and saw Chad standing by himself. He signaled him over.
The young man walked up to them, and Irvin Irving made the introduction.
Do you mind if I speak with Chad alone for a few minutes, Councilman?
Irving looked like he had been betrayed, but didn't want to reveal it in front of his grandson.
Of course, he said. I'll be at the car. We'll be leaving soon, Chad.
And, Detective, I want to hear from you.
You will, sir.
Bosch put his hand on Chad Irving's upper arm and steered him away from his grandfather. They walked toward a stand of trees in the center of the cemetery. There was shade there,
and privacy. Chad, I'm sorry about your father's death. I'm looking into it and hope to know what happened very soon.
Okay.
I hate to bother you at this difficult time, but I have a few questions, and then I can let you go.
Whatever. I don't really know anything.
I know, but we need to talk to everybody in the family. It's routine. Let's start with, when was the last time you spoke to your father? Do you remember?
Yeah, we talked on Sunday night.
About anything specific?
Not really. He just called, and we sort of shot the shit for a few minutes about school and stuff. But it was sort of bad timing. I had to go, so that was it.
Where did you have to go?
I had a study session set up, and I had to go.
Did he say anything about his work, or any sort of pressure he was under, anything that was bothering him?
No.
What do you think happened to your father, Chad? The boy was big and gangly, his face scattershot with acne. He shook his head violently at the question. How should I know? I had no idea what was going to happen. Do you know why he would have gone to the Chateau Marmont and rented a room?
I don't know.
Okay, Chad. That's all. I'm sorry for the questions, but I am sure you want to know what happened.
Yes.
Chad looked down at the ground. When do you go back to school?
I think I'll stay with my mother for at least the weekend.
She'll probably need that. Bosch pointed to the cemetery lane where the cars were waiting. I think she and your grandfather are waiting for you. Thanks for your time.
Okay.
Good luck, Chad.
Thanks.
Bosch watched him walk back toward his family. He felt sorry for the kid. He seemed to be walking back to a life of demands and expectations that he had no part in conjuring. But Bosch couldn't think about it too long. He had work to do. As he started walking toward his own car, he pulled his phone and called his partner. It took Chu 6 rings to answer his phone.
Yeah, Harry.
What have they come up with? Bosch had requested and received the department's top forensic team to go back into the chateau and look for interpretations as well as evidence that might link Mark McQuillan to the homicide.
We got nothing, so far at least.
Okay, were they out on the fire escape yet?
They started there. Nothing.
Bosch couldn't say he was disappointed because he knew it was a long shot in the first place, especially on the fire escape, which had been exposed to outside elements for nearly 4 days. Do you need me there?
No, I think we're going to wrap soon. How was the funeral?
It was a funeral. Not much else to say. In order to bring Chu in and oversee the second forensic examination of the crime scene, Bosch had told him in general terms where the investigation was moving.
Then what's next?
Bosch climbed into his car and started the engine. I think it's time we spoke to Mark McQuillan.
All right, when?
Bosch had been thinking about that, but wanted to consider the how, when, and where questions further. We'll work it out when you get back to the PAB. Bosch disconnected and dropped the phone into his coat pocket. He loosened his tie slightly as he drove out of the cemetery. Almost immediately, his phone buzzed and he assumed Chu was calling back with another question. But instead it was Hannah Stone's name on the ID screen.
Hannah? Hello, Harry. How are you?
I just left a funeral.
What?
Whose? Somebody I never met. It was work. How are things at the center?
They're fine. I'm on a break.
Good. He waited. He knew she wasn't calling just to pass the time.
I was wondering if you've been thinking about last night.
The reality was that Bosch had been consumed by the Irving case since he had confronted Robert Mason the night before. Of course, he said. That was pretty wonderful for me.
It was wonderful for me, too. But I didn't mean that. I meant about what I told you before.
I'm not sure what you mean.
About Sean, my son.
This felt jagged and awkward. He wasn't sure what she wanted. Well, I don't know, Hannah. What am I supposed to be thinking about?
Never mind, Harry. I need to go.
Wait, Hannah, come on. You called me, remember? Don't go, and don't get upset. Just tell me, what am I supposed to be thinking about with your son?
Bosch felt something gripping his insides.
He had to consider that for her the night before may have been some sort of means to a hopeful end that was about her son and not them. To Bosch, her son was lost. When he was 20 years old, he had drugged a girl and raped her. A sad and terrible story. He pleaded guilty and went to prison. That was 5 years ago, and Hannah had dedicated her life since then to trying to understand where the impulse in him had come from. Was it genetic? Was it nature? Was it nurture? It was a form of prison in itself for Hannah, and Bosch felt sympathy as she had told him the ugly story. But now he wasn't sure what she wanted from him besides his sympathy. Was he supposed to say her son's crime was not her fault? Or that her son wasn't evil? Or was she hoping for some sort of concrete help in terms of her son's incarceration? Bosch didn't know because she hadn't said.
Nothing, she said. I'm sorry. I just don't want it to ruin anything, that's all.
That eased things for him a small bit. Then don't let it, Hannah. Just let things happen. We've only known each other a few days. We like to be with each other, but maybe we moved too quickly. Let's just let things happen, and don't bring this other stuff into it, not yet.
But I have to. He's my son. Do you have any idea what it's like to live with what he did and to think about him up there?
The grip inside tightened again, and he understood he had made a mistake with this woman. His loneliness and his own need for connection had led him down the wrong path. He had waited so long, and now had chosen so wrong. Hannah, he said, I'm in the middle of stuff here. Can we talk about all of this later?
Whatever.
It was said as an invective. She might as well have said, fuck you, Bosch. The message was the same. But he acted like he had not received it. Okay, I'll call you as soon as I'm clear. Goodbye, Hannah.
Goodbye, Harry.
Bosch disconnected and fought the urge to throw the phone out the car window. His thinking that Hannah Stone could be the one he brought into the life he shared with his daughter had been a fool's dream. He had moved too quickly. He had dreamed too quickly. He shoved the phone into his coat pocket and buried thoughts about Hannah Stone and failed romance as deep as George Irving had just been put in the ground.
Chapter 26. Bosch entered the empty cubicle and immediately saw the stack of large envelopes on Chu's desk. He put his briefcase down on his own desk, but then went over to Chu's and spread the envelopes across his blotter. Chu had received the statements and other records from George Irving's credit cards. Going back and checking all credit card purchases was an important component of a thorough death investigation. Their findings would become part of the victim's financial profile. The bottom envelope was the thinnest and was from the crime lab. Bosch opened this one, wondering which case it was in regard to. The envelope contained the report on the analysis of George Irving's shirt. Forensic testing determined that the navy blue dress shirt contained blood and cellular material, skin, on the inside right shoulder panel. This was consistent with the crescent moon-shaped bruises and lacerations found on Irving's shoulder during the autopsy. Bosch sat down at Chu's desk and studied the report and considered what it meant. He realized it could indicate at least two scenarios. One was that Irving was wearing the shirt when he was choked out, and the injury to the skin on his shoulder occurred when the choker's watch pushed through the material of the shirt. The second was that the shirt was put on after the wounds occurred and the blood and skin was transferred. Two things led Bosch to discount the second scenario. The button found on the floor indicated there may have been a struggle while Irving was still wearing the shirt. And because Irving had plunged naked to his death, it seemed highly unlikely that the shirt was put on over the wound and then removed again. Bosch zeroed in on the first scenario. It suggested that Irving was surprised from behind and locked into a chokehold. There was a struggle. The button was torn from the right sleeve, and the choker moved into the shoulder creep maneuver to control the victim. The bruises and surface abrasions occurred despite the shirt. Bosch thought about this for a few minutes, and no matter which angle he took on it, it still led back to McQuillan. As he had said to Chu, it was time to bring McQuillan in. Bosch moved over to his desk and started planning the takedown. He decided it would not be a felony arrest. He would seek McQuillan's voluntary agreement to come downtown to the PAB and answer questions. If this effort was unsuccessful, then cuffs would come out, and he would be arrested. McQuillan was a former cop, and this made him a dangerous arrest target. Almost all ex-cops owned guns and knew how to use them. Bosch would have Chu run a check on the ATF gun registry, but he knew that such a check would not be conclusive. Cops picked up and seized guns on the street all the time. Not all of them were turned into property. An ATF backgrounding would only tell them what McQuillan legally owned. Because of these concerns, Bosch determined first and foremost that McQuillan would not be approached at home. That would put him too close to whatever known and unknown weapons he had. His car would also be a poor choice for the same reasons. Bosch had already seen the inside of the B&W garage and dispatch office. This gave him a strategic edge. It would also be the least likely place for McQuillan to be armed. It would be one thing if he was driving a cab on the dark edges of Hollywood, but dispatching cabs there was not as dangerous. The desk phone rang, and the screen simply said LA Times. Bosch was tempted to let it go to message, but then thought better of it. Open unsolved.
Is Detective Bosch there?
Speaking.
Detective, this is Emily Gomez-Gonsmart, across the street at the Los Angeles Times. I'm working on a story about the murder investigation of George Irving, and I want to ask you a few questions.
Bosch froze for a long moment. He had a sudden desire for a cigarette. He knew of the reporter. She was nicknamed Gogo because she relentlessly pursued the stories she was following.
Detective?
Yes, sorry, I'm in the middle of something here. You called it a murder. What makes you think it is a murder investigation? It's a death investigation, yes, but we have not called it a murder. We have not made that conclusion. Now she paused for a moment before answering.
Well, my information is that it is a murder investigation, and there is a suspect who will be arrested soon if he has not already been taken into custody. This suspect is a former police officer with an axe to grind against both Councilman Irving and his son. That's why I'm calling you, Detective. Can you confirm this, and have you made an arrest in the case?
Bosch was stunned by the depth of her information. Look, I'm not confirming anything. There has been no arrest, and I am not sure where you're getting your information, but it's not correct. Her voice changed now. It became more of a whisper, and it carried an intimate, "who are you kidding?" quality to it.
Detective, she said, we both know that my information is correct. We are going with the story, and I would like your comments for the record. You are, after all, the lead investigator, but if you can't or won't talk to me, then I'll go without you, and I will report just that you refuse to comment.
Bosch's mind was scrambling. He knew how it worked. The story would be in the morning's paper, but long before that, it would go out online through the newspaper's website. And when it hit the digital universe, it would be read by every assignment editor at every television and radio station in town. Within an hour of the post on the Times website, there would be a media frenzy. And whether named in the story or not, McQuillan would know Bosch was coming for him. Bosch couldn't have that. He couldn't have the media rush him or dictate his moves in any way. He realized that he had to cut a deal here. "Who's your source?" he asked, just to gain a little time to consider ways of handling this. Gogo laughed, as Bosch knew she would. "Detective, please. You know I can't reveal my sources. If you want to become an unnamed source, then I would offer you the same absolute protection. I'd go to jail before revealing sources, but I would prefer to have you on the record." Bosch raised his head and looked out of the cubicle. The squad room was mostly deserted. Tim Marcia was at his desk near the lieutenant's office. The LT's door was closed, as usual, and it was impossible to know if she was holding up in there or out at a meeting. "I wouldn't mind going on the record," he said, "but you know that with a case like this, with the political connections and whatnot, I can't go on the record without permission. It could mean my job. You'll have to hold back until I can get it." He hoped that by saying his job was on the line, he'd get some sympathy time. Nobody wants to cause somebody to lose their job, not even a cold and calculating reporter. "This sounds like a stall to me, Detective Bosch. With you or without you, I have the story, and I am filing it today." "Okay, then how long can you give me? I'll get back to you." There was a pause, and Bosch thought he could hear her typing on a computer keyboard. "My deadline is at 5. I need to hear from you before then." Bosch checked his watch. He had just gotten 3 hours from her. He believed that would give him enough time to take down McQuillan. Once he was in custody, it didn't matter what was on the internet or how many reporters and producers called him or the media relations office. "Give me your direct number," he said. "I'll get back to you before 5. Bosch had no intention of calling her back, but he wrote her name and number down in his notebook anyway. As soon as he hung up, he called Kiz Ryder on his cell. She answered right away, but sounded like she was in a car.
"Yes, Harry."
"Are you alone?"
"Yes."
"The Times has the story. It came from either the chief or the councilman. Either way, I'm fucked if it gets out too soon."
"Hold on, hold on. How do you know?"
"Because the reporter just called me, and she knew we're working it as a murder, and that we have a suspect who's an ex-cop. She's been told everything."
"Who's the reporter?"
"Emily Gomez Gonsmart. I've never talked to her before, but I've heard of her. Supposedly they call her Gogo, because she doesn't give up on a story."
"Well, she isn't one of ours."
Meaning Gogo wasn't on the list of approved and trusted reporters the chief of police dealt with. This meant her source was Irvin Irving, or someone on the city councilman's staff.
"But you're saying that she knew you had a suspect?"
Ryder said. "That's right. She knows everything but the name. She knew it was either about to go down or it already did."
"Well, reporters often act like they know more than they do, as a way of tricking you into confirming things."
"She knew we had a suspect, and he's an ex-cop, Kiz. That wasn't a bluff. I'm telling you, she knows it all. You people up there better get on the phone and jump on Irving's shit for this. It's his own son, and he's damaging the case for what? Is there a political advantage to putting this out now?"
"No, there isn't. That's why I'm not convinced it went through him. And the thing is, I was in the room when the chief got him on the phone and updated him. He held back on the suspect because he knew Irving would demand to know the name. So he left that out. He did tell him about the marks on the shoulder and the chokehold connection, but he did not say that there was a named suspect. He said we were still working on it."
Bosch was quiet as he contemplated the meaning of all of this. It fell under the heading of High Jingo, and he knew there was no one to trust other than Kiz Ryder.
Harry, I'm in the car. What I suggest you do is go online and get into the Times website. Put in a search with the reporter's name. See what comes up in previous stories. See if she's done stories involving Irving before. Maybe there's a staffer she's connected to, and it's obvious from previous stories.
It was a good and savvy idea.
Okay, I'll do it, but I don't have a lot of time. This is forcing the issue with McQuillan. As soon as my partner gets in, we're going to go grab him.
You sure you're ready?
I don't think we have a choice. This story hits the internet at 5 o'clock. We need to grab him before that.
Let me know the moment it goes down.
You got it. Bosch disconnected and immediately called Chu, who should have already cleared the Chateau Marmont.
Where are you?
Heading in.
We got nothing, Harry.
Doesn't matter. We grab McQuillan today.
Your call?
Yeah, my call, and I'm making it. See you back here. He disconnected and put his phone down on the desk. He drummed his fingers. He didn't like this. His case actions were being dictated by outside influences. It never felt good. Sure, the plan was to get McQuillan and bring him in for questioning. But before, Bosch was setting the pace. Now it was being set for him, and it made him feel like a tiger in a cage. Confined and angry, ready to put a paw out through the bars and take a swipe at the first thing that goes by. He got up and went over to Tim Marcia's desk. Is the LT in?
Yeah, she's in there.
Can I go in? I need to give her an update.
She's all yours, if you can get her to open up.
Bosch knocked on the agoraphobic lieutenant's door. After a pause, he heard Duval give the okay, and he went in. She was at her desk, working on the computer. She glanced up to see who it was, but then finished typing something as she spoke.
What's up, Harry?
What's up is that I'm going to be bringing in a body today on the Irving case. This made her look up. The plan is to get him to come in voluntarily, but if that doesn't work, we'll hook him up.
Thanks for keeping me in the loop.
It was not said as a sincere thanks. Bosch had not updated her in 24 hours, and a lot had happened in that time. He pulled out the chair in front of her desk and sat down. He gave her the short version, taking 10 minutes to lead her up to the phone call from the reporter.
My bad for not keeping you updated, he said. Things have just been breaking quickly.
The chief's office is up to speed. I just spoke to his adjutant today at the funeral, and they'll let the councilman know.
Well, I guess I should be glad you kept me in the dark. Now I won't be a suspect in the leak to the Times. Any idea about that?
I'm assuming it was Irving or someone in his camp.
But what does he get out of this? He's not going to end up looking good here.
It was the first time Bosch considered this. The lieutenant was right. Why would Irving leak a story that was ultimately going to taint him with, at minimum, the whiff of corruption? That didn't make sense.
Good question, Bosch said, but I don't have an answer. All I know is that it got across the street somehow.
Duval glanced at the blinds that covered the window, looking out at the Times building. It was as if her paranoia about reporters watching had been confirmed. Bosch stood up. He had said what he needed to say.
What about backup, Harry? Duval asked. You and Chu can handle this by yourselves?
I think so. McQuillan won't see us coming, and like I said, we want him to come voluntarily. She thought about this and then nodded.
Okay, let me know. In a timely manner this time.
Right.
That means tonight.
You got it. Bosch went back to the cubicle. Chu still wasn't back. Harry was consumed by the suggestion that the leak hadn't come from the Irving camp. This left the chief's office and the possibility that moves were being made that Kiz Ryder didn't know about or that she was hiding from him. He went to his computer and opened up the Times website. In the search box, he typed Emily Gomez Gonsmart and hit return. Soon he had a page full of citations, the headlines of stories that carried the reporter's byline in reverse chronological order. He started scrolling through,
reading the headlines and quickly coming to the conclusion that Gogo did not cover politics or city government. There were no stories in the last year that put her in proximity to Irvin or George Irving. She appeared to be a feature writer who specialized in crime stories, the day later kind of stories in which she expanded on a crime, reporting on victims and their families. Bosch clicked on a few of these, read the opening paragraphs, and then went back to the list. He scrolled backward through more than 3 years of stories, not seeing anything that would connect Gomez Gonsmart to anyone involved in the George Irving case. And then a headline from early 2008 caught his eye. Triads exact toll on local Chinese. Bosch opened the story. It was an anecdotal lead about an old woman who owned an apothecary store in Chinatown and who had been paying a monthly protection fee to a triad boss for more than 30 years. The story then widened into a report on the cultural history of local small business owners, continuing the age-old Hong Kong-based tradition of paying triad crime syndicates for protection. The story was spawned by the then-recent murder of a Chinatown landlord that was suspected to have been a triad hit. Bosch froze when he got to the ninth paragraph of the story. "The triads are alive and well in L.A., said Detective David Chu, a member of the LAPD's Asian gang unit. They prey on people like they've preyed on people in Hong Kong for 300 years. Harry stared at the paragraph for a long moment. Chu had transferred to the Open Unsolved Unit and to partnering with Bosch 2 years earlier. Before that, he worked in AGU, where he had crossed paths with Emily Gomez Gonsmart, and it seemed he had continued the relationship. Bosch killed the screen and turned in his seat. Still no sign of Chu. He rolled over to his partner's side of the cubicle and opened the laptop Chu had left on his desk. The screen lit up, and Bosch clicked on the email icon. He glanced around again to make sure Chu had not entered the squad room. He then opened a new email and typed in Gogo in the address box. Nothing happened. He deleted it and typed Emily. The automatic feature that completed email addresses that had been previously used took over and filled in emilygg@latimes.com. Bosch felt a rage building. He looked around once more and then went into the email account sent file and searched for all emails to Emily GG. There were several. Bosch started reading them one at a time and quickly realized they were innocuous. Chu only used email to set up meetings, often at the Times cafeteria across the street. There was no way to determine the kind of relationship he had with the reporter. Bosch closed out the email screens and closed the laptop. He had seen enough. He knew enough. He rolled in his chair back to his own desk and contemplated what to do. The investigation had been compromised by his own partner. The ramifications of this could extend all the way into court if McQuillan was eventually prosecuted. A defense attorney with knowledge of Chu's impropriety could destroy his credibility as well as the credibility of the case. That was just part of the case damage. It didn't even speak to the irrevocable damage that had just been dropped on their partnership. As far as Bosch was concerned, that relationship had just ended. "Harry, you ready to rock?" Bosch turned in his seat. Chu had just entered the cubicle. "Yeah," Bosch said. "I'm ready." Chapter 27. A taxi garage was much like a police station. It operated solely as a hub for the refueling, maintenance and direction of vehicles that endlessly spread out across a geographic jurisdiction. And, of course, it was the place where those vehicles were replenished with those who drove them. The vehicles were always in play until mechanical failure pulled them out of the lineup. In that, There was a rhythm that could be counted on. Cars in, cars out. Drivers in, drivers out. Mechanics in and mechanics out. Dispatchers in and dispatchers out. Bosch and Chu sat on Gower and watched the front of the black-and-white taxi garage for nearly an hour before they saw the man they believed was Mark McQuillan park a car on the curb and then walk in through the open garage door. He wasn't what Bosch expected. In his mind's eye, he was thinking of the McQuillan he remembered from 25 years earlier, the McQuillan whose photo was splashed across the media as the scapegoat of the chokehold task force. The 28-year-old stud with the buzz cut and the biceps that looked strong enough to crush a man's skull, let alone his carotid artery. The man who sauntered into B&W Taxi was thicker in the hips than the shoulders, had straggly hair in an unkempt gray ponytail, and walked with the pace of a man going where he didn't really care to go. "That's him," Boss said. "I think." They were his first words in 20 minutes. He had very little to say any more to Chu. "You sure?" Chu asked. Bosch looked down at the copy of the driver's license photo Chu had printed. It was 3 years old, but he was sure he had it right. "Yeah, let's go." Bosch didn't wait for his partner's response. He got out of the car and headed diagonally across Gower toward the garage. He heard the other door slam behind him and Chu's shoes on the pavement as he scurried to catch up. "Hey, are we going to do this together, or is it one-man army time?" Chu called out. "Yeah," Boss said. "Together. For the last time," he thought. It took a moment for their eyes to adjust to the dim lighting of the garage. There was more activity than on their previous visit. Shift change. Drivers and cars coming and going. They headed directly to the dispatch office, not wanting anyone to get the news to McQuillan before they got to him. Bosch rapped on the door with his knuckles as he opened it. As he stepped in, he saw two men in the room, just as before. But one was McQuillan, and the other was a new man as well. McQuillan was standing by his workstation, spraying a disinfectant on the radio headset he was about to put on. He seemed unfazed by the appearance of the two men in suits. He even nodded as if to signal that they were expected. "Detectives," he said. "What can I do for you?" "Mark McQuillan?" Bosch asked. "That would be me." "Detectives Bosch and Chu, LAPD. We want to ask you a few questions." McQuillan nodded again and turned to the other dispatcher. "Andy, you hold the fort. Hopefully this won't take long." The other man nodded and gave the smooth seize signal with his hand. "Actually," Bosch said, "it might. Maybe you should see if you can get someone in." This time McQuillan spoke while looking directly at Bosch. "Andy, call Jeff. Get him out. I'll be back as soon as I can." Bosch turned and gestured toward the door. McQuillan started out of the office. He was wearing a baggy shirt that was not tucked in. Bosch stayed behind him and kept his eyes on his hands the whole time. When they got into the garage, he put his hand on McQuillan's back and directed him toward a taxi that was on Jack's. "Do you mind putting your hands on the hood for a minute?" McQuillan complied, and when he did so, his wrists extended past the cuffs of his shirt sleeves. Bosch saw the first thing he was hoping to see, a military-style watch on his right wrist. It had a large steel bezel with grip ridges. "Not at all," McQuillan said. "And I'll tell you right now that in my right front waistband you will find a little two-shot popper I like to carry. It's not the safest job in the world. I know you have it tougher, but we work in there through the night, the garage door always open. We take each driver's bank at the end of shift, and sometimes the drivers themselves aren't the nicest guys, if you know what I mean." Bosch reached around McQuillan's substantial girth and found the weapon. He pulled it out and held it up to show Chu. It was a Cobra Derringer with a big bore barrel. Nice and small, but hardly a popper. It could fire two 38 caliber rounds, and they could do some damage if he used it up close enough. The Cobra had been on the list of guns McQuillan had registered, and that Chu had pulled up on the ATF computer. Harry put it into his pocket. "You have a concealed weapons permit?" Bosch asked. "Not quite." "Yeah, I didn't think so." As Bosch finished the pat-down, he felt what he was sure was a phone in McQuillan's right front pocket. He left it in place, acting as though he had missed it. "Do you shake down everybody you bring in for questioning?" McQuillan asked. "Rules," Bosch said. "Can't take you in the car without cuffs unless we do the pat-down." Bosch wasn't exactly talking about department rules, more his own rules. When he had seen the Cobra on the ATF report, he guessed that it was a weapon McQuillan liked to carry on him. There wasn't really much other reason to have a pocket pistol. Harry's first priority was to separate him from it and anything else that might not have been on the ATF's radar. "Okay," he said, "let's go." They walked out of the garage and into the late afternoon sun. Walking on either side of McQuillan, the detectives led him toward their car. "Where are we going for this voluntary conversation?" McQuillan asked. "The PAB," Bosch replied. "Haven't seen the new building, but if it is all the same, I'd rather go to Hollywood. It's close, and I can get back to work sooner." This was the start of a cat-and-mouse game. The key thing from Bosch's perspective was to keep McQuillan cooperating. The moment he shut down and said, "I want a lawyer," was the moment everything halted. Being a former cop, McQuillan was smart enough to know this. He was playing them. "We can check if they have the space," Bosch said. "Partner, give them a call." Bosch had used the code word. As Chu pulled his phone, Bosch opened the back door of their sedan and held it until McQuillan piled in. He closed it and over the hood of the car gave Chu a hand signal, like a cutoff motion. The meaning was, "We are not going to Hollywood." Once they were all in the car, Chu proceeded to fake a phone call with the lieutenant in charge of the detective squad room at Hollywood Division. "LT, Detective Chu, RHD. My partner and I are in the vicinity and would like to borrow one of your 9x9s for about an hour if we could. We could be there in 5. Would that be all right with you?" There was a long silence followed by, "I see," 3 times from Chu. He then thanked the lieutenant and closed his phone. "No good, they just rolled a DVD counterfeiting warehouse, and they got all 3 rooms stacked. It will be a couple hours." Bosch glanced back at McQuillan and shrugged. "Looks like you get to see the PAB, McQuillan." "I guess so." Bosch was pretty sure McQuillan had not fallen for the charade. On the rest of the drive, Bosch tried to make small talk that would either elicit information or lower McQuillan's guard. But the former cop knew all the tricks of the trade and remained mute almost the entire ride. This told Bosch that the interview at PAB was going to be difficult. Nothing was more difficult than trying to get a former cop to talk. But that was okay. Bosch was up to the challenge and had a few things up his sleeve he was pretty sure McQuillan hadn't seen. Once they got into the PAB, they walked McQuillan through the vast RHD squad room and then placed him in one of the Open Unsolved Unit's 2 interview rooms. "We just need to check on a few things and we'll get right back to you," Bosch said. "I know how it works," McQuillan said. "See you in about an hour, right?" "No, not that long. We'll be right back." The door automatically locked when he pulled it closed. Bosch went down the hall to the next door and stepped into the video room. He started the video and audio recorders and then went to the squad room. Chu was at his desk, opening the envelopes containing George Irving's credit card records. Bosch took his own seat. "How long are you going to let him cook?" Chu asked. "I don't know, maybe a half hour. I missed his cell during the pat-down. Maybe he'll make a call and say the wrong thing, and we'll have it on video. Might get lucky." "It's happened before." "You think he's walking out of here tonight?" "I kind of doubt it, even if he gives us nothing." "Did you see his watch?" "No, he's got long sleeves." "I saw it. It fits. We book him and take the watch, and it goes to forensics. We go for DNA and wound matching. DNA will take a while, but maybe they can make the wound match by lunch tomorrow. And then we go to the DA.
Sounds like a plan.
I'm going to get a cup of coffee. You want something? Bosch turned and looked at his partner for a long moment. Chu's back was to him. He was putting the credit card reports into one stack and tapping the edges clean.
Nah, I'm fine. As long as you're letting him cook a while, I might sit down and look at all of this stuff. You never know.
Chu got up, putting the credit card data into a fresh green file.
Yeah, you never know.
Chu walked out, and Bosch watched him go. He then got up and went to the lieutenant's office, popping his head in and telling Duval that they had placed McQuillan in interview room 1 and that he was there voluntarily. He then went back to his desk and texted his daughter, making sure she had gotten home safely from school. She replied quickly, as her phone was an extension of her right hand, and they had a rule that they never delayed responses to each other. Home safe. Thought you were working last night. Bosch wasn't sure what she was getting at. He had taken pains that morning to erase any indication that Hannah Stone had been there. He sent back an innocent response, and then she nailed him. 2 wine glasses in the Bosch. They always called the dishwasher after its manufacturer's name. Bosch realized he had left one detail uncovered. He thought for a moment and then typed out a text.
They were getting dusty on the shelf. I just washed them. But I am glad to know you are doing your chores.
He doubted it would get by her, but he waited 2 minutes and there was no reply. He felt bad about not telling her the truth, but it wasn't the right time to open up a discussion with his daughter about his romantic life. Deciding he had given Chu enough of a head start, he took the elevator down to the ground floor. He went out the front entrance to the PAB and over to Spring Street, where he crossed and entered the Los Angeles Times building. The Times had a full cafeteria on the bottom floor. The PAB had snack machines, and that was it. In what was billed as a gesture of neighborliness, when the new police headquarters was opened a couple years earlier, the Times had offered use of its cafeteria to all PAB officers and workers. Bosch had always thought it was a hollow gesture, primarily motivated by the financially beleaguered newspaper's hope to make at least the cafeteria profitable, while no other department in the once powerful institution was. After badging his way past the security desk, he entered the cafeteria that had been put in the cavernous space where the old printing presses had turned for decades. It was a long room with a buffet line on one side and rows of tables on the other. He quickly scanned the room, hoping to see Chu before his partner saw him. Chu was sitting on the far side of the room at a table with his back turned to Bosch. He was sitting with a woman who looked like she was of Latin descent. She was writing in a notebook. Bosch walked up to their table, pulled out a chair, and sat down. Both Chu and the woman looked like they were being joined at the table by Charles Manson.
"I changed my mind about the coffee," Bosch said.
"Harry," Chu blurted, "I was just
telling Emily here about our case."
Bosch looked directly at Gomez Gonsmart. "Isn't that right, Emily?" he said. "Or can I call you Gogo?"
"Look, Harry, it's not what you think," Chu said.
"Really? It's not? Because it looks to me like you're laying out our case for the Times right here on their home court."
He quickly reached out and grabbed the notebook off the table.
"Hey," Gomez Gonsmart cried, "that's mine."
Bosch read the notes on the exposed page. The notes were in some sort of shorthand, but he saw repeated notations about McQ and the phrase watch match equals key. It was enough to confirm his suspicions. He handed her the notebook.
"I'm going," she said, as she snatched the notebook out of his hands.
"Not quite yet," Bosch said, "because you two are going to sit here and work out a new arrangement."
"You don't tell me what to do," she snapped.
She pushed back her chair so hard, it fell over as she stood up.
"You're right, I don't,"
Bosch said, but I do have your boyfriend's future and career in my hands here. So if any of that means anything to you, then you'll sit down and hear me out. He waited and watched her. She pulled her purse strap over her shoulder, ready to walk off. Emily, Chu said.
Look, I'm sorry, she said. I have a story to write.
She walked away, leaving Chu's face drained of blood. He stared into the distance until Bosch snapped him out of it. Chu, what the fuck did you think you were doing?
I thought...
Whatever it was, you got burned. You fucked up, and you better start thinking of a way to back her off. What exactly did you just tell her?
I told her we brought McQuillan in and that we were going to try to turn him in the room. I told her it wouldn't matter if he confessed or not, if the watch matched the wound.
Bosch was so angry he had to hold back from swinging at Chu and smacking the back of his head. When did you start talking to her?
The day we got the case. I knew her from before. She did a story a few years ago and we had a few dates. I always liked her.
So she calls up this week and starts leading you by the dick right into my case.
Chu turned and looked at him for the first time. Yeah, you got it, Harry. Your case, not our case, your case.
But why, David? Why would you do this?
You did this. And don't start calling me David. I'm surprised you even know my first name.
What, I did this? Are you?
Yeah, you. You cut me out, Harry. You wouldn't tell me shit. And you cut me out, made me chase down the other case while you ran this one. And this wasn't the first time. More like every time. You don't do that to a partner. If you had treated me right, I would never have done it.
Bosch composed himself and calmed his voice. He sensed they had drawn the attention of people sitting at nearby tables. Newspaper people. We're not partners anymore, he said. We finish out these two cases, and then you put in for a transfer. I don't care where you go, but you're out of OU. If you don't do it, I'll make it known what you did, how you sold out your own partner and your case for a piece of tail. Then you'll be a pariah, and nobody and no unit outside of IAD will take you. You'll be outside looking in. Bosch stood up and walked away. He heard Chu call his name weakly, but he didn't turn back around. Chapter 28 McQuillan was waiting with his arms folded on the table when Bosch re-entered interview room 1. He checked his watch, apparently not realizing its importance to the coming conversation, and then looked up at Bosch.
35 minutes, he said. I thought you'd go over an hour easy.
Bosch sat down across from him, putting a thin green file on the table. Sorry, he said. I had to bring a few people up to date on things.
No problem. I called the job. They've got me covered for the whole night, if necessary.
Good. So I guess you know why you're here.
I was hoping we could have a conversation about Sunday night. I think that to protect you and to make this formal, I should let you know about your rights. You've come here voluntarily, but it's my practice to always let people know where they stand.
Are you saying I'm a murder suspect?
Bosch drummed his fingers on the file.
That's a hard one to say. I need some answers from you, and then I will make a conclusion about that.
Bosch opened the file and took out the top sheet. It was a rights waiver containing a printout of McQuillan's constitutional protections, among them the right to have an attorney present during questioning. Bosch read it out loud and then asked McQuillan to sign it. He handed him a pen, and the ex-cop turned cab dispatcher signed without hesitation.
Now, Bosch said, are you still willing to cooperate and talk